Cloud Show. I'm your host, Kimberly Cloud. Wow. You know, I've had a lot of great people on my show, but I would like to say this guy right here, we had special chemistry. Like through the video, he was able to tell me about his famous book. He was able to tell me about his Fortune 500 companies he's attended. And we're going to refresh the audience memory, go over it, and hopefully, you know, we get more information out of this brilliant soul, this brilliant mind. So everyone give a big round of applause to Ari Brish. Hi, Mr. Brish.
Hey, Kimberly. Thanks for having me. Good to see you again.
It's good to see you. Now, we're going to start off right now talking about your past leading up into your present. And then I'm going to pick different topics, highlight your resume topics, such as Fortune 500 companies you work for and many other great places. So go ahead and talk about your past leading up into your present, however long you want to talk about it.
So Kimberly and I go back, what, 2 or 3 years?
Yes.
And we just recently reconnected when Kimberly is starting her MBA program. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Everybody congratulate Kimberly. So that brings to the last chapter in my career is teaching business students here in St. Edward's University, both bachelor business students as well as MBAs. So I feel connected to the fact that you are starting your MBA program. I wish you were my student, but it's okay if you're not. So going back almost 50 years, I would say, I had to, you know, age myself so badly. My choice of my career going back 50 years was just totally emotional. I'm talking in my book, and the book is behind me, by the way, and in my teaching about emotional decision-making when you purchase stuff, when you do business decisions, or in my case, when you do career decisions. Back in 1973, before Kimberly was born, there was a major energy crisis in the world, and they started the nuclear. They wanted to, I said, the government wanted to have more nuclear energy sources, so they started an accelerated class in nuclear physics and nuclear engineering to train quickly a group of people to operate in these nuclear engineering power stations. So just because it was new, I signed up for this program. I didn't know anything about energy, nothing about nuclear engineering, just an emotional decision. Next step, a few months later, situation in the world changed a little bit, and they said, no, we'll change our mind. No more nuclear engineering. We don't need you anymore. Sorry about misleading you, but we will let you choose any school you want in the university without any additional testing, except of electrical engineering. So the moment they said except of electrical engineering, once again, I made an emotional decision to prove them that when they tell me you cannot join it without testing, I said, I'll show you. And applied for electrical engineering, once again, not having any clue what it means, what does electrical engineering does. You know, first thing in the morning, I had no clue. But I chose it just because they said you cannot have it. So it was an emotional decision. Now, today, in my book and my teaching, I talk a lot about emotional decisions in your personal purchasing, when you choose a car or the color of your phone or whatever, where you choose where to live, and even in business-to-business decisions, People think that business to business is very business oriented motivations. You'll be surprised how much emotions are going into business to business decisions.
And I mean, so what about your, you can continue if you want, because we know that you wrote a book, you know, so can you continue till you get to the book part? What made you write that book too?
Okay. So that's like 40, 50 years ago into the future. So my, well, we can go back and forth. No problem. Yeah, actually, it's all connected. By the way, going back to 1973, I keep telling in my book and my students in my teaching, every crisis creates opportunities. We just saw recently COVID created opportunities and created another crisis, by the way, with COVID, with this video conferencing like we're doing now. The entire semiconductor capacity of the whole world went to feed all this video equipment. And that created a huge shortage of technology chips, semiconductor chips to the automotive market. And you couldn't get new vehicles in 2021 and 2022. You couldn't get new vehicles just because the production line was full of automobiles waiting for some stupid $20 semiconductor chip that went to Zoom or to Cisco or to Google.
Mr. Bush, what do you think could be changed about that? You said that basically the equipment was on hold because of the semi-microconductor chip. So what do you think, seeing that you have extensive resume history, what do you think as an engineer should be done on the front lines with production of cars?
Yes. So back in the days when I used to work for Motorola Semiconductor, we were the number one semiconductor supplier to the automotive industry. Mm-hmm. And we had a golden rule, which answers your question. Automotive is number one priority. Why? Not just because we did lots of business with automotive, but we realized that if you have 1,000 vehicles in the production line, you do the math, 1,000 vehicles times $20,000 or $30,000 or $50,000 waiting for just tiny semiconductor chip to be plugged into the vehicle. And automotives have tons of technology. Today, when you buy an automobile, 20 to 40% of the value of the automobile is in the technology, not in the metals, not in the engine, but in the technology that controls the automobile. So if you buy a $20,000 automobile, $5,000 and $7,000 is the technology, the software and the semiconductor chips that go into the engine and the other parts of the automobile. So we realized you cannot let, you know, 1,000 automobiles just wait for days, sometimes weeks and months for some semiconductor chip. So we put a priority, number one priority, on supplying the automotives. And then we supply to other things. So if you want to buy a new telephone, you can wait a few more weeks for the next model. Nothing, no big harm and no big damage to the suppliers, whether it's an Apple or Samsung or whatever the phone is coming from. So that's painful, but not disaster. In the case of automobiles, it was pretty close to disaster to have so many vehicles waiting on the production line just for some technology components. I know people that had a used vehicle, so that created an over demand on used vehicle. So people were able to sell their 2 or 3 years old vehicle for higher price than the ticket price of a new vehicle, because the demand was so high, when you cannot get something, you'll pay any price for a 2 or 3 years old automobile, used automobile.
Mr. Bush, yes. What is a semiconductor chip, by the way?
Semiconductor chip is, I wish I had one here. Like in any electronics, take this phone. The electronics inside the telephones are semiconductor chips. There are several ones providing all the smarts of the phone, controlling the videos, controlling the keyboard, controlling, storing the information, storing all your pictures.
So it's like the brain?
Yes, it's like the brain and the memory of your phone, of your computer. And also an automobile, there is lots of technology. You think the engine is running by itself? No, there is a small computer controlling the engine of the automobile to ride in the most optimum way. And you have remote control on the keys. You can change the seats electronically. You have the displays, the GPS in the automobile. You have the radio. There is lots of technology, even in an automobile, that semiconductor is basically the building block. Think about it as the building block of any electronics, entertainment, TV, your TV at home, your telephone, your automobile, your computer.
Do you
anything
think that
has semiconductor chips? What?
Do you think that is good to market and create these microchips on United States soil? Because I heard that we could be, or we are in the future, going to produce semi-microconductor chips in the United States instead of Tokyo, I believe. Do you think that that's saving us money or hurting us?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So back in the days, the U.S. Technology industry or semiconductor industries was all based in the U.S. Over the years, the business world, including technology, became more and more global. And you can see manufacturing of whether it's a semiconductor or whether it's your TV set at home or whether it's a computer, whether it's a vehicle. The supply chain is coming from all over the world. And the semiconductor, like we saw in 2020 during the COVID, became a key building block in almost anything. Now the government is waking up, the U.S. government is waking up and saying, oh, there is too much dependency on overseas. So they're trying to bring some of it back so we will not be dependent on other countries in something so strategic as, you know, putting technology in. You know, the government care less about your automobile, but they do care about, you know, military technology, for example, which also depends on semiconductor chips. The same debate is going on as far as energy. To what extent should we use U.S. oil versus buy from outside, and that debate is going on for the past 10, 20 years. Any strategic assets of raw material, whether it's oil, semiconductor, to some extent is a strategic asset now these days. To what extent do we want to be dependent on our own production versus overseas? And it's a big question. And today, it's becoming bigger. There was some period between the 19, after the Cold War. Mm-hmm. Cold War kind of ended during the 1990s. People had the attitude that, okay, now we are starting peaceful times and no more war. And we love Russia, we love China, we love all these countries. But in the past few years, you know, with the conflict between Russia and Ukraine and conflict between, about to have a conflict between China and Taiwan and Middle East and what have you, people in this country, the government in this country is starting to realize that the utopia of world peace is not happening tomorrow morning. Therefore, we need to start thinking about bring back all the strategic capabilities back on the U.S. soil. And you know, you can argue if it needs to be 50% or 50% or 70%, 30%. People have all kinds of opinions, but the main issue is something so strategic to the existence of a country should be controlled by being in the country.
You feel
there
like
was you- there was a just this week, Donald Trump talked in Ohio, I believe, about import of Chinese vehicle to this country, and you know, the Detroit people are scared to death by this because it will threaten all the jobs in Detroit. Most of many of the jobs in Detroit are automotive dependents, and the more cheap vehicles are being imported without any government regulations, people in Detroit, Michigan are going to lose, thousands of people are going to lose their jobs.
So what you're saying, I have to recap what you're saying. You're saying that our President Biden is trying to bring more cars from China onto the United States soil.
I didn't say Biden is trying, but there is a trend. I don't think it's one president versus another. There is a trend to bring more. It started in the 1970s where U.S. started to bring Japanese cars and then Korean cars, and now about to bring Chinese cars. And that's threatened jobs in Detroit. Detroit was by far the number one automotive supplier in this country, by far. Like 90% of the vehicles back in 1970, 90% of the vehicles were U.S. made. Now that's not the case anymore.
Well, let's take a look behind the scenes. What are we getting? Are we getting paid? Well, it sounds like to me that we're getting, or America is getting, like a chunk of money for bringing imported cars here. And that's like, is that true? I mean, because what would be the reason why we would accept imported cars and have America lose money like Detroit?
Right. A very good question. Because think about that. So one argument is for you and me as citizens of this country and consumers of this country, be able to buy cheaper vehicles. That's argument number one. On the other side of the equation, if you and me will buy Chinese cars because they're cheaper, somebody in Detroit or thousands of people in Detroit will lose their jobs.
Yes.
So the president is having to balance between you and I be able to buy cheaper cars versus thousands of people in Detroit losing their jobs. It's hard to tell what's more important.
Where do you see the future, if like two futures? Where do you see the future going in a positive way if we decide to have cars come here? Or where do you see it going in a negative way if we decide to have cars here? Or where do you see it going if we decide to say, no, we're not having imported cars, we're going to make our own cars, and et cetera?
So if I'm watching what happened between Japanese suppliers, vehicle suppliers like a Toyota, Honda, and the U.S. vehicles, if you compare how many of the vehicles are being made in the U.S., you'll be surprised that Japanese vehicles, many of them are made in the U.S., or parts of them are made in the U.S. Why? Because the Japanese automotive makers are realizing, or they know, you have to give back to the community that buy your products. And one way to give back is to create jobs. So every Toyota or Honda vehicles you buy, a certain percentage of the value of the vehicle was made in the USA. And the opposite is true also. Many U.S. manufacturers, General Motors, Ford, and what have you, some percentage of these vehicles is made somewhere else, in Canada, in Mexico, in Europe. So it's not a black and white question. Understood. Now, what the government can do with the new threat of import from China is making the regulatory situation that will encourage those automotive suppliers to make more of their vehicles here in the US. And there are reasons for them to do it anyhow, because if I know that a car XYZ is made in the US, I don't care if the headquarters is in China or Japan or Germany or wherever, if it's made in the US, providing US jobs, I feel better about buying this vehicle versus a case where if I buy this vehicle, some guy in Detroit is going to lose their job just because me buying this vehicle. So there is, we talked before about emotional decision making. One of the reasons for people to buy this car or that car is emotional. People have emotional consideration whether they choose to buy an American-made vehicle versus a foreign-made vehicle. And the Japanese know that, understand it. That's why they have factories here in the U.S. Toyota has big presence, thousands of jobs here in Texas, for that reason.
Before we move on and talk about your book, I have one more, like, because you're on fire right now. So let's talk about Tesla. I think that, you know, we're in phase one, stage one, even though he's developed a lot of Tesla cars over the years, but I feel like we're in stage one with electrical cars. Tell me, how do you feel about it, and what would you do to upgrade it into even a better, because you're an engineer, always will be. So tell me what you think should be done about, like, possibly making Tesla more safer.
Yeah, going back, before we answer your question directly, people perceive electrical cars as the saving the environment or saving planet Earth. That's not necessarily the case, because the batteries for electrical cars, for example, there is so much chemistry into the battery that has to be mined in different places all over the world, that instead of mining petrol of, you know, oil, you mine these other chemicals. I'm not a chemist to tell you, but there is lots of exotic chemicals, by the way,
that
that are even less available than oil, at least today, that mining all these chemicals to make the batteries is causing an environmental issue somewhere in the world, okay? The other thing will be in the future. The batteries, like even in your telephone, the battery dies eventually after a few years. The same will happen with the electrical vehicle. But now this battery, you throw it away, you never think about it. But when all these giant batteries for electrical cars will have to be disposed, that's another environmental damage that I don't know if the industry is even prepared to handle.
Could we recycle, or he find a type of material or exotic materials that he can recycle, so when the battery finally dies, we can, like, trade it in like an iPhone?
Hopefully people will create the recycling, as you said, good idea. People or the industry will create some recycling operations like we do with plastics and papers and metal cans or beer cans or whatever. So hopefully this will happen. But today there is not enough batteries being dumped, or not at all, I think, because this is so new that this crisis is about to happen, but haven't happened yet. Maybe it will start to be a crisis 5 years from now when some of these early electrical vehicles will have to dump the batteries. And by the way, when you buy a used electrical vehicle, you have to pay attention to how much life the battery has, which is something you don't have to think about when you buy a normal, you know, gasoline-powered vehicle. In a used electrical vehicle, if it's a little old, like 5 years or something more, you have to think, okay, how much life the battery has? Because once you have to dump the battery and buy a new battery, that's thousands of dollars you have to invest in installing a new battery into your vehicle.
Do you know anything about the giga plants that he's built?
Yeah, it's huge here in Austin.
Yeah.
It's huge, thousands of people. So from an Austin economy point of view, it's like, welcome Tesla to Austin. Yeah, definitely, definitely. You should move to Austin also.
Yeah. It's, Thank you. Can you tell me about... what made you create your book and tell the people what your book is called and tell them that it's a bestseller?
Okay, so the book has a little confusing name. It's called Lay an Egg and Make Chicken Soup. Yes. It plays on the, every time you consider a new initiative, a business initiative, or a new product or a new service, there is a chicken and an egg question. So that's where the name is coming from, not to be confused with real chicken soup that you eat. But Amazon confuses it sometime. When you look for my book, it will come up in the cookbooks or something. So in a sense, it's a cookbook for business innovations. So you can view it that way. And the book is structured in a way that will give you a step-by-step guidance of what do you need to commercialize innovation. Because having a good idea is the first step, but in order to make it a commercial success, there is lots of execution details and blind spots and risk you have to take care of that the book is guiding through. My best example is the invention of the light bulb. I have light bulbs above me. Most people think,
wait,
Thomas...
before you go there, is it true, Mr. Engineer? I learned in biology. I took a biology class. That's nothing compared to you. But I learned that a regular light bulb, it just ticks. It, the light beams like that so fast that we cannot even see, that it's just like pulsating. Is that true?
Yes, I think to some extent, yes. You can, by the way, some vehicles, instead of having a normal mirror, they have a rear camera, mm-hmm, instead of a real mirror. Mm-hmm. And in those vehicles, you'll see that the vehicles behind you, that if the lights are on, you'll see the lights flickering.
Also in
videos, sometimes when you watch a movie, you'll see the lights are flickering. That's because of what you just said, that the light is not always continuous. But going back, everybody thinks Thomas Edison invented the light bulb. No, he did not invent the light bulb. The light bulb was invented 50 years before Thomas Edison. What Thomas Edison did, he commercialized it. So the guy that invented the light bulb in the UK, in England, didn't think about the commercial potential for it. So he just proved that you run electricity through a filament, the filament will glow and create light. And he was a physicist, he was a scientist. So in his mind, he proved a scientific phenomena that made him happy. Thomas Edison took this idea and took it through all the tests and all the designs and commercial and manufacturing and created ecosystem to make it happen. The glass around the filament, the gas inside, how to connect it to the electrical system, all of that, and make it, manufacture it in a price that you can afford and make it reliable enough so you don't have to change every day, you have to change every few months only. All of this Thomas Edison did. He had 300 patents on top of this original invention. He had 300 patents to make it a commercial success.
You know, I had an invention. I have many inventions, but this particular invention, I'm glad that Seattle picked it up real quick. But I made it in 2016. It was called the K-Cloud Smoke Detector. That was phase one of it. It was artificial intelligence, and it's something you plug in your home, in a room, or a hotel, a motel with the motherboard system, or a car. If you smoke cigarettes, if you smoke marijuana, if you smoke whatever, any type of smoking substance, it will pick it up and it will register in the system so that the person that does not smoke, if you say in a rental car place, don't smoke, and they smoke, you have the efficient evidence that they smoke, because they'll argue, well, I didn't smoke. And so Seattle picked it up and they have it in the library. I saw it on the news one day and I was like, well, hey, it is what it is.
No, that's a great idea. So now, to commercialize this, you need to find a big enough partner that, you know, can build it, can sell it to different rent-a-car, different apartment, different hotels. And there will be different models, by the way, with the same basic idea. One model for car rentals, another model for hotel rooms, and blah, blah, blah. So you see all the details that goes behind the invention, and I think it's a great idea. I'm renting a car now, and it says no smoking. I'm a no smoker, so I don't care about the no smoking, but sometime you walk into the vehicle, you can smell that somebody smoked.
And they'll argue that they did.
Yeah, right, exactly. So I think it's a great idea. The other thing, artificial intelligence, by the way, I'm glad you mentioned, it became a buzzword these days. Every time you can attach the word artificial intelligence to anything, it becomes popular and people will pay attention. Artificial intelligence, yeah.
Did you hear about the super artificial intelligence that's coming out by 2026 or something?
Super, no, I didn't hear about super.
They put super behind it. I read it. Yes.
So actually, I'm glad you mentioned the super, because like any other technology, it's evolving. It's not like overnight, suddenly people discovered artificial intelligence. I wrote an artificial intelligence software back in 1985.
Wow. 1985. I was
1 year old. Yeah. But back then, it wasn't a buzzword, number one. There was no smartphone to run it. It ran on a mainframe computer for a whole week to come out with the results. So it was very specific for applications that it intended and was willing to pay the price to run on a computer, mainframe computer that cost $1 million for a week, to solve a problem that otherwise, you, without artificial intelligence, you couldn't even solve. So it's evolving, and part of this evolution is to find a way to implement it in an affordable price. So today you get artificial intelligence, I have it on my computer, I use it all the time. Anytime you ask ChatGPT a question, it's free. It will give you some answer, which in many cases is good answers. In some cases, they're cheating, by the way. I had like at least half of the questions I asked. I kind of know the answer, but I don't know all the details, and they come back with an answer that I know it's not correct. So when you use artificial, I'm telling you as an MBA student, when you use artificial intelligence for your homework, you have to be mindful and double check if the answer you got from the ChatGPT is a correct answer or not.
Another thing that I decided for the future that may happen is, I said to myself, I know everything that's on YouTube. I'm not being showboating or boasting, but I said to myself, I know everything that's on YouTube, a person, an animal, a sky, a building, a house. So I said, why not sit up there and start charging people and develop some type of neural wave system where if they want to learn a certain section, it's no way people can learn all of YouTube in a year or all of YouTube in their lifetime. It's too much video. So I said, why don't, if they want to learn, start having some type of neural wave pathway where they beam it into your brain somehow, some way. I'm just saying it would be a prototype, and you get to learn about different sections, and you learn about it, and you pay, to get these memories embedded into your memory. I really would like to do something like that. I know
By the way, you're frozen, by the way, for a few seconds. So if you said something important in the last 10 seconds, I missed it.
Can you hear me?
Now I can hear you well, yes.
Okay, so what I wanted to know, because you're the engineer, I wanted to see if I know what's on YouTube. I said, I know that it's a person, it's a building, it's an animal, it's a sky, night or day, it's everything, like basic stuff. You see the same thing. You never see aliens, you just see a animation or simulation of aliens. But the point is, what I want to do is get a simulation where if you want to see, you never can see all of YouTube within a year. You're not going to be able to see YouTube within your lifetime, all of YouTube within your life. So if you wanted to see all of YouTube and study history and Egyptian history and all the greatest things that you can't seem to get to because you're too busy, then it will be some type of neural pathway to beam into your brain, and you charge them for you to learn that way. I wanted to try to phase that in the future. How do you think about that?
Yes, so that's a very good question. I think Google are working on it.
Oh, yay!
All the time. It's an evolving question that Google get better and better and better in doing it. Where you ask something, you get the replies back. If the replies is not satisfactory, you ask the same question in a different way until you get the results, or you use ChatGPT. Once again, you ask the question. In many cases, you don't get exactly the answers you want to get. So you ask the same question in a different way. You start to get the different answers, and you put together all the different answers, and you build in your mind, or you build for yourself exactly what you're looking for. So it's an evolving skill of the search programs. That's what basically Google started to do. When Google was founded, it was founded on the notion that they can second guess what your priorities are, and they'll bring up in the first page what they think you're exactly looking for, even though there is tons of information, as you said. And if it doesn't come up on the first page, you change the question, and sometimes you'll get a different list on the first page. Mm-hmm. And by the way, the opposite, when you are a supplier who wants to make sure you come up on the first page on Google, the techniques, it's called search engine optimization. There are different techniques to improve your chances of being part of the first page when people are searching for something that you provide. So definitely a good question, definitely an evolving science, so to speak, that, or algorithms to second guess based on the question you ask, but also based on previous searches you did. Mm-hmm. Like if I'm looking up a certain vehicle I want to buy, suddenly my Facebook and my LinkedIn and everything, I get advertising for the same vehicle because it's all connected, and they start to second guess what I'm interested in. So the same thing, the Google algorithms, they learn to read your mind, so to speak, and bring up things you're looking for that they think you're looking for, but it's not in black and white. My favorite saying, I don't know if I made it up or somebody else made it up, the more I know, the more I know how much I don't know. Right? Okay. So it's true for...
Explain it. I am so confused. The more I know, the more I don't know. Tell me,
yeah.
Mr. Grish.
Yeah, right. So that's why you see people in any profession specializing. If you go to a doctor, there is specializing in different aspects. You go to a dentist. Back in the days, you go to a dentist, the dentist does everything. Now you go to a dentist. If you need a crown, they send you to another dentist. If you need gums operation, they send you another special. There are multiple specialties in dental, right? Same thing with different physicians, same thing with restaurants, same thing with everything. People specialize because the amount of information is so enormous that if you don't specialize, the human brain cannot handle so much knowledge.
Not one last thing, but we're going to still get back to your book, but I have two questions. Did you hear about the guy that got fired from Google that said that there's a project going on where it's a robot that's 7 years old that has emotion? So he got fired from Google, and I don't think they brought him back yet, but there was also artificial intelligence going wrong where they were spewing out on a certain search website, like different negative slurs. So what do you feel about that, about artificial intelligence having emotion?
Right, so I think that's a premature. Now, people claim, for example, that ChatGPT has emotions or racial bias. It's not. It's the people that enter the information in a way that the answers come back as a racial bias. It's not a racial bias of the software. It's a racial bias of the people that enter all the information to the database. So when you say a robot has an emotion or a computer program has an emotion, it's all about the emotion that you feed it to have. So it's not the computer emotion, it's the emotions of the people that feed it. Now the people that feed them information, their bias is often unintentional. They don't have any bad intentions by feeding this information or that information, but they have an unconscious bias of, you know, feeding certain information, and they don't even know the damage they may cause when the ChatGPT comes back with an answer that could offend could offend certain people?
You know, when we start to build robots, I feel like computers, and we already have robots out there, but they're not walking down the street or talking to us. Like, but I say to myself, you know, the only way a robot will change and turn evil is if we, like you said, put a virus or put something negative in it. I think that police officers should have stealth technology, because I think we need to start cracking down on crime more, where they have, like, for instance, the best thing is a cloak, a type of sheath material that's like a mirror. You throw it on your body, you reflect the light, and you look invisible. So I think they should have that technology for their cars. And, you know, that way they can see a crime happen and they'll be there right away and see it happen. I know this is too advanced, but that's how I feel. And, you know, mirrors are very special. You know, we're looking through a mirror. We're looking at ourselves right now. Mm-hmm. And I think that the only way a robot will have any negative memory of anything, I think robots are special, is mm-hmm. if they have a virus. What is your input? And then we're going to talk about your book.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So once again, a robot is just a computer with some machine attached to it, and the machine is doing something it's programmed to do. Like today, we have a garbage day in our street. The garbage truck has a robot in it. The robot picks up the garbage can and dump it into the truck. That's only something that happened in the last 2 or 3 years. Before that, there were humans coming out of the truck and picking up it manually. We talked about the automotive industry. Automotive industry is full of robots now doing parts of the job, but there is humans controlling the robot. Now, somebody may program the robot to write, you know, to paint a slur on the automobile. It's not the robot has a bad intention. It's the person that program the robot to write a bad slur, to paint the automobile with some racial slur or something. So robots are, they don't have their own mind. Even if you think they have their own mind, it's because they were, whoever programmed them, either intentionally or unintentionally, programmed them with misleading information. To your example, by the way, about crime, the technology is there to find crimes before they happen. It's more about, okay, I have artificial intelligence that with a camera that, I don't know, sitting on a downtown street, busy street, and it can guess that this person walks in the street, has some bad intentions.
Yes, that's what I'm talking about. That's a good idea, Mr. Brooks.
Yeah, the technology is there. It's not a technology question. It's more a privacy question. What would the police do about it? Can they stop a person just because the artificial intelligence told the police that it thinks this person has some bad intentions? In some countries, they would do that. Yes. Here in the U.S., I don't think it will fly.
To piggyback off of you, there was a woman that was at a abortion clinic, and they arrested her, and they kept asking her the same questions. What were you thinking about? They kept making it seem like she was thinking about like hurting the police, because she had a sign saying the police is wrong for not allowing, or the government is wrong for not allowing abortion. And they said, What were you thinking? Yeah, so they may have that technology there over
there. Yeah, they have that technology, but depends on the rules and regulations and privacy rules, different countries. Here in this country, you cannot arrest a person just because they think about doing something bad. You have to wait until they do the bad thing, or at least threaten to do a bad thing, not just thinking about it.
Tell me about the first chapter in your book and what it meant to you, if you can remember it. I know you can.
Yeah, it's a difficult question. The book started as just independent articles I wrote, blogging in different places. And it took me probably 1 or 2 years to realize, okay, all these papers I wrote, I can put it together into a book. Okay. So it started as an independent articles that I wrote. Mm-hmm. And later I put it into a book. Even my family didn't know that I'm writing a book until like a few months before I published it, because I had the raw material evolved. Nothing happens overnight, right? So the Roma, it's not like I woke up one morning and decided to write a book. No, I writing different things at different occasions. And one day I realized I have enough material for a book. So all I had to do is to glue it all together. I had the basic material just to glue it all together.
Can you tell me about your progression with Forbes? I think you were in Forbes, I think. I researched that.
Oh, yeah, Forbes. So
I tried, before you say that, I tried my best to fill out the application, but they said you don't qualify. I was like, darn it. I filled it out, but tell me about it.
Yeah. So the same thing. I wrote in Forbes different examples. All around commercializing innovation. And one of the things I like, by the way, you're a young person, you go back 100 years or 200 years, and there is a business case study that the lesson learned is relevant up to today, like the invention of the light bulb is one example. You can go even farther back in the past. The first computer was invented in the UK, in the England again in 1850-ish or something.
Get out of here. I thought it was invented by United States on United States soil.
No. So it was mechanical, it was not even electronic, it was mechanical computer with mechanical things moving, real moving.
How did they get it? I have to ask, how did they get it where it's like a computer screen and the system?
No, it was not screen, it was like very basic mechanical movements that gave an answer at the end, and it was very primitive. It was not like computers we know today, but it was a computer with all the basic building blocks that a modern computer has, but much more primitive. Mm-hmm. And the lesson learned, it is true even today, two things. They ran over budget, so the investment came from the English government or the UK government. Mm-hmm. They ran over budget until the government say, you guys don't know what you're doing. We're not giving you any more money. It happens every day today in the Silicon Valley when founders and entrepreneurs running over budget and the investors pull out the plug. So that's one lesson learned. The second lesson learned, the two founders of this venture didn't get along or had an argument about the percentage each one of them will have in the new venture, and that was a destructive thing, and the relationship fell apart. That also happened pretty often in new ventures that you hear about in any entrepreneurship. So the lesson learned, the relationship between the founders is very important. Most of the startup that I've seen failing, they failed because of human issues.
Okay.
The people didn't get along, or one of the founders had to find a job because they couldn't wait so long for new funding to come in. and blah, blah, blah. So relationship between the founders and or relationship between the founders and the investors. That's another human aspect. Some founders think, okay, the investors are just a money machine. Bring money, bring money, bring money. No, it's people that manage other people's money. And if you don't find a way to work together, it's eventually not going to work.
One last thing, and then I'm going to ask how the people can reach you. So you know how you have a camera. I guess cameras here was invented by two individuals. I forgot their name. You have cameras, you get what? A negative. You walk in the sun, you see what? A shadow. I was in under 2 minutes. Tell me about, what do you think about Wi-Fi? Wi-Fi is very complicated, and maybe it could have a negative effect, such as, you know, I can't say it because it's controversial. So I say, what is your on-site? Because everything has a negative. Wi-Fi we use every day. Some people don't even get Wi-Fi in certain rural areas. So under 2 minutes, tell me your insight on the negative, what could happen with negative aspects of Wi-Fi.
Anything, any technology, anything can be misused in a negative way. Even automobile. We talked about automobile. I can use automobile to kill people. And
okay, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So the same thing about, there's lots of debates in this country about weapons control. The same thing. If I want to kill somebody, I can run over with them with my automobile, or I can buy a gun and kill them. Wi-Fi may have misuse if a government use it for the wrong purposes. We talked about arresting people just because they think what they think. That's another example. But yet, without Wi-Fi, we couldn't have this conversation. Mm-hmm. So it's all about how you use the technology and how to make sure you don't misuse it.
One last question. I have to say this. How is Wi-Fi created? Is it like a telescope or some type of device out outer space that beams down to give
You're
us...
You're talking about Wi-Fi in the office or at home?
Period. As a whole, Wi-Fi, how is Wi-Fi created? Like, how do we do it?
It's like any wireless communication that probably was invented maybe 100 years ago or so. I'm not sure about the exact timing. But back in the days, it was point-to-point communication that was created for military purposes.
Yes.
And then telephone communications was some through a wire, some through wireless. Yeah. And then one of the major milestones in wireless communication is the invention of cellular phones. And the invention of cellular phones created a system.
Hey, real quick, how can the people reach you?
Okay, either LinkedIn is the best, or my website is cxo360.net.
Okay. Thank you so much, Ari. Oh my God. I love you. I hope you and your family have a wonderful day. I'm going to call you. I have your number. I'm going to call you afterwards to talk to you about some things, but thank you for joining my show. You've been awesome.
Same to you. I didn't even realize we're talking for an hour. Time flies when you enjoy yourself.
Yes. You take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.